Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of just absolute precision,
Right,
right?
like engineering.
Exactly, like engineering. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line right across the bone, and the doctor just points a pen at it and says, there it is, that's the problem. It's totally black and white.
Right, it's undeniable.
But then you step into the world of municipal securities on the Series 7 exam.
Yeah, and that x-ray machine is just completely broken.
Completely broken. You are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is, honestly, it's just incredibly murky. You're trying to figure out who owes what to whom, which taxes apply, and like whether a town is actually going bankrupt or just moving money around.
It's muddy, very muddy waters.
So muddy. But before we clear up that mud, a really quick word. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at certfuel.com. Okay. Let's unpack this. Welcome to the deep dive.
It really is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters, like you said. And that is exactly why we're here today. We want to give you the exact tools you need to read the x-ray of the Series 7 Municipal Securities chapter.
Yes, we do.
And let's be incredibly clear right out of the gate here. This is only the first half of the municipal securities beast.
Yeah, just part one, because it's function three of the exam, right? For those of you tracking the weight of the test, it represents roughly 20 questions across the municipal units.
20 questions.
20. It is huge. It's heavily tested. It is it's basically the dragon you have to slay. But listen, we are not going to just read you a textbook today.
No, absolutely not.
If you wanted a dry lecture where someone just recites bullet points, you wouldn't be here. Our mission today is to deeply learn, retain, and actively apply these concepts so you can walk into that exam center and just absolutely crush it.
Right, because we really want to focus on the why. Why did these rules even exist in the first place?
Exactly.
Because if you understand the underlying logic, like the actual mechanics of how a city funds a project, you'll never have to rely purely on just, rote memorization.
Which is impossible anyway with this much material.
Yeah, it's too much. But if you know the why, you will be able to deduce the correct answer even if the exam throws some bizarre scenario at you that you've never explicitly seen before.
And to make sure this actually sticks in your brain, we're going to introduce a cast of recurring characters. We are going to build a little cinematic universe here because, well, human brains remember stories, not spreadsheets.
That is so true.
So you're going to be hearing a lot about these three people today. First up, we have Mayor Mike.
Ah, Mayor Mike.
Mayor Mike is an overly ambitious, somewhat delusional local politician. He is constantly trying to fund ridiculous town projects. And his current obsession, he wants to build a massive solid gold statue of himself right in the middle of the town square.
Naturally. I mean, because every thriving municipality needs a solid gold monument to its mayor.
Obviously. It's an economic driver, right? Come on.
Sure.
Okay. Second, we have Careless Carl. Carl is an investor who falls for literally every single Series 7 exam trap. If there's a wrong answer on a multiple choice question, like a distractor designed specifically to trick you, Carl is picking it with total confidence.
Oh, Carl. Yeah. He doesn't read the fine print. He makes massive assumptions. And frankly, his portfolio is just a walking disaster.
A complete disaster. And finally, we have Prudent Tenny. She is the complete antidote to Carl. She's a sharp, eagle-eyed investor. She always reads the prospectus. She understands the legal covenants, and she maximizes her yields while rigorously minimizing her risks.
When you sit down for that exam, you really want to channel your inner Prudent Penny.
Yes. Be Penny. Do not be Carl. Okay, so let's start laying the groundwork. Before Mayor Mike can even dream of funding his solid gold statue, we need to understand the absolute basics of the municipal bond sandbox. What are the rules? What's the paperwork? And why do people even care about these bonds in the first place? I mean, why not just buy corporate bonds and call it a day?
Well, the allure of the municipal bond all comes down to one single beautiful word for investors.
Taxes.
Taxes, exactly. When we say municipal securities, we are talking about debt issued by states, cities, counties, school districts, water authorities, basically any political subdivision.
Yeah.
And the defining feature, the primary reason investors flock to them, is that the interest paid on these bonds is generally exempt from federal income tax.
It's the triple tax-free holy grail.
It is.
Let's break this down into a real-world scenario so you can really visualize it. Let's say you live in New York City and you buy a New York City municipal bond. That interest you earn every 6 months, it is completely exempt from federal tax.
Right off the bat.
Furthermore, because you live in the state of issuance, it's exempt from New York state tax. And because you live in the city itself, it's exempt from New York City local tax. Yeah. Triple tax free. You get to keep every single penny of that interest.
Exactly. But you have to pay attention to geography here. If you live in New York and you decide to buy a California municipal bond, you still get the federal tax exemption. The IRS still stays away.
Right.
But California isn't going to give a New Yorker a tax break, and New York State is certainly going to tax you on your out-of-state income. So the ultimate benefit really depends heavily on where you live and where the bond is issued.
I always like to compare municipal bonds to an exclusive VIP club. It's a VIP club where the cover charge to get in, which in this analogy is the yield, is actually lower than the club next door. Corporate bonds pay a higher yield, so the municipal cover charge is lower. But the drinks inside, the returns, are completely tax-free.
I love that analogy.
So, who benefits the most from this VIP club? High rollers. Investors in high tax brackets. Think about it. If you're a young worker in the 10% tax bracket, a tax-free bond doesn't do much for you. You're way better off taking the higher yield of a corporate bond and just paying the tiny 10% tax.
Yeah, the math just wouldn't make sense for them.
Right, but if you are a massive earner in the 37% tax bracket, shielding that income is incredibly valuable.
It's massively valuable. The math proves it out with tax-equivalent yield calculations, which we'll save for another time. But the core concept is exactly right. High tax bracket equals high municipal bond demand.
Now, here is where we hit our first massive exam trap. I want you listening to this to pay very, very close attention.
All right, ears open. What is the trap?
Okay, so municipal bonds are classified as exempt securities under the Securities Act of 1933. Yeah. This means they do not have to go through that grueling, expensive SEC registration process that corporate bonds do. They don't have a standard formal prospectus.
Oh, okay.
So let me ask you a direct question. Ready?
Ready. If municipal bonds are exempt from SEC registration under the 1933 Act, they must be exempt from anti-fraud rules too, right?
Take a beat. I want you to really think about that. Give it a second. What do you think? Is it exempt from anti-fraud?
Wrong. Careless Carl thinks that because the bond is exempt, he can just lie on the official statement.
Mm.
He notices a massive sinkhole forming right where the gold statue is supposed to go, and he just leaves that out of the disclosure documents.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Careless Carl goes to federal prison.
Okay, let me stop you there, because this is exactly where people get tangled up. You're telling me it's municipal debt, it's the government issuing it. Doesn't the SEC usually stay out of local government business? If they don't have to register it, why is Carl going to jail?
Because nothing, and I mean absolutely nothing, is exempt from the anti-fraud provisions of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Nothing.
Nothing. It doesn't matter if it's a U.S. Treasury bond, a municipal bond, or a share of stock in a shoe company. Exempt from registration simply means you bypass the initial paperwork and the waiting period. It does not mean exempt from anti-fraud. If you lie, cheat, steal, or omit material facts in the securities industry, you are committing fraud, and the federal government will absolutely prosecute you. Write that down in permanent marker.
Okay, that makes total sense. Fraud is fraud. But that actually brings up a really interesting question about the regulators themselves, because there is a very specific dynamic here that the exam absolutely loves to test. Who is actually making the rules for these municipal dealers? We hear a lot about the MSRB, right? The Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board.
Yeah, the MSRB is the primary rulemaking authority for municipal securities dealers and municipal advisors. They write the rules governing how these professionals must conduct their business, how they advertise, how they handle customer complaints, and what sort of disclosures they need to make.
Right.
But here is the grand irony of the MSRB.
Okay, the MSRB is basically a mall cop with a notepad, but no radio and no handcuffs. Let's be real here. They sit in a room, they write all these incredibly strict rules, but they have absolutely zero enforcement power. None. They cannot fine a broker dealer. They cannot suspend a license. They cannot arrest Careless Carl.
That's entirely correct, and it is a highly, highly testable fact.
Yeah.
If a broker dealer breaks an MSRB rule, the MSRB cannot punish them. The actual enforcement of MSRB rules for broker dealers is carried out by FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, or the SEC itself.
Okay, what about bank dealers?
For bank dealers, it's enforced by the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, or the Comptroller of the Currency. So if a multiple choice question asks, who enforces MSRB rules, and you confidently click the MSRB, you just became Careless Carl.
The MSRB writes the rules. FINRA and the SEC bring the hammer down. It's such a weird system, but you just have to know it.
You really do.
All right, let's get into the actual math mechanics of this foundation. Nuts and bolts time. When you buy a corporate bond, the face value you get back at maturity is almost always $1,000. But what about munis?
Municipal bonds have a standard denomination of $5,000. This is crucial when you are calculating dollar prices on the exam. If a corporate bond is quoted at a price of, say, 98, that means 98% of $1,000, which is $980.
Right.
But if municipal bond is quoted at a price of 98, that means 98% of $5,000.
Let me do that math out loud so we can all follow. 98% of $5,000. Well, 100% is $5,000. 2% of $5,000 is $100. So $5,000 minus $100 is $4,900. One single municipal bond quoted at 98 costs $4,900.
Spot on. But we need to clarify how these are typically quoted in the real world, because you just used a dollar price quote, and that is actually not the norm for most municipal bonds.
Wait, really? I thought all bonds traded on a dollar price. Like, I'll give you 98 cents on the dollar. That's not how it works.
Actually, no. Most municipal bonds are quoted on what we call a yield basis, which is also known as a basis price. So instead of a dealer quoting a dollar amount, they will look at their screen and say, this bond is trading at a 3.50 basis.
Okay.
That means the bond is priced so that it yields exactly 3.50% to maturity. Yield basis is the absolute default for munis. If an exam question gives you a quote of 4.25 and doesn't explicitly say whether it's dollars or yield, you must assume it's a yield basis.
Good rule of thumb. But some of them DO trade on a dollar price, right? Which ones are those?
Yes. Specifically, term bonds trade on a dollar price. They're sometimes called dollar bonds. And we will get into the exact structural difference between serial and term bonds in just a second. But first, let's talk about the calendar. How does interest actually accrue on these bonds if you buy or sell them in the middle of a month?
Oh, this is one of my favorite quirks. Everyone listen to me carefully. Wake up. Clap your hands if you have to. I need you to burn the sequence of numbers into your mind right now. 30, 360. Say it with me. 30, 360.
It sounds absurd, but it's vital. When you calculate accrued interest for a municipal bond, you do not look at a real calendar.
You don't.
You do not care if it's February with 28 days or October with 31 days. You pretend mathematically that every single month has exactly 30 days. And you pretend the year has exactly 360 days.
Mm-hmm.
This is the exact same fabricated calendar method used for corporate bonds.
And why does this matter so much for the exam? Because government bonds, like U.S. Treasury notes and bonds, exist in reality. They use actual days in the month and 365 days in the year.
Right.
The test writers know this is confusing. They will try to trick you by giving you a municipal bond problem and asking you to calculate accrued interest, hoping you will use the 365-day calendar. Don't do it. Munis and corporates live in the fictional 3360 universe. Treasuries live in the real, actual, over 365 universe.
Yeah, don't let him catch you on that.
Yeah.
Now, let's circle back to those maturity structures I mentioned. Mayor Mike is sitting in his office looking at the blueprints for his solid gold statue.
A beautiful statue.
Gorgeous. So he needs to borrow $10 million. He has to make a fundamental choice about how the bonds he issues will mature over time. Does he want to pay off that entire $10 million loan on the exact same day 20 years from now? Or does he want to pay off a little bit of the principal every single year to spread out the pain?
Let's compare the structures directly. Serial bonds versus term bonds.
Okay. A serial bond issue has multiple maturity dates. It is staggered. A portion of the principal matures in year one, another portion matures in year two, another in year three, and so on. It is very much like paying off a standard home mortgage. You are slowly whittling down the principal balance over time.
Makes sense.
And critically, each maturity date usually has its own specific interest rate. The one-year bond might pay 2%, while the 10-year bond from the exact same issue might pay 4%.
I picture serial bonds like a giant staircase. Mayor Mike takes it one step at a time, paying off a little piece of the debt as he climbs. It's manageable. So what about term bonds?
Term bonds are like getting into an elevator and taking it straight to the top floor without stopping. All the bonds in a term issue mature on a single specific date.
Okay.
Mayor Mike borrows $10 million today. He pays interest along the way. And then he owes the entire $10 million lump sum on December 31st, 2045. Boom. One massive payment day.
That seems terrifying for a city budget. Just a massive cliff they have to jump off at the end. And then there's the weird cousin of the two, right? The balloon maturity.
Right. A balloon maturity is technically a type of serial bond.
Mm-hmm.
It has multiple staggered maturity dates early on, but a massive, disproportionate chunk of the principal is scheduled to mature on the very last date. It's a serial bond that suddenly inflates into a huge, ballooning final payment.
Okay, we have one more critical piece of paperwork to cover before Mayor Mike can actually start digging the foundation for a statue. The legal opinion. Every municipal bond issue has a legal opinion attached to it, provided by a specialized independent law firm called Bond Counsel.
Yes, and this leads us directly to another major trap that catches test takers off guard constantly.
All right, listen closely. I have a direct question for you. Let's say Mayor Mike issues his bonds, and the Bond Counsel provides a clean, unqualified legal opinion.
Sounds good so far.
Does that clean legal opinion mean that Mayor Mike's town is financially sound and the bond is a perfectly safe investment for a prudent penny? I want you to think about it. Does a lawyer's signature guarantee financial safety? Take a second.
Nope, not even a little bit. The legal opinion addresses exactly two things and nothing else. One, the legality of the issue. Did Mayor Mike actually have the legal authority under state and local law to issue these bonds, or did he just print them in his basement?
Good question.
And two, the tax-exempt status. Does this bond actually meet the IRS requirements to qualify for the federal tax exemption?
That is it. It has absolutely nothing to do with creditworthiness, default risk, or financial safety. Mayor Mike's town could be entirely bankrupt. The gold statue could be actively sinking into a swamp. But as long as the paperwork was filed legally and the taxes are exempt, that bond counsel will issue a clean, unqualified legal opinion.
Yep.
Careless Carl sees the words unqualified legal opinion and thinks, wow, this is a risk-free investment. Prudent Penny knows that the lawyers only check the rules. She still has to do her own deep dive credit research to see if the town can actually pay her back.
Exactly. And what happens if a bond is floating around in the secondary market and it doesn't have a legal opinion attached to it at all?
Then it trades what we call ex-legal. It is perfectly legal to trade, but it's much, much harder to sell. It is significantly less marketable because buyers are nervous. It's like buying a used car from a guy in a parking lot without the title.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it.
The engine might run fine, the radio might work, but you're going to sweat bullets until you get that official paperwork proving it's actually yours and legit.
Absolutely. Okay, let's follow Mayor Mike's journey as he tries to actually get this money. We are moving into the world of general obligation bonds, or GIGO bonds.
So Mayor Mike has figured out all the basic muni rules. He knows he needs a $5,000 denomination. He knows about the 3360 calendar. But he realizes that to actually build his solid gold statue, he needs real cash. How is he going to get it?
Right.
He looks out his office window at all the houses and businesses in his town, and he decides he's going to tax the citizens to pay for his statue. Enter the general obligation bond.
A general obligation bond is exactly what it sounds like. It is a broad general obligation of the issuing municipality. It is backed by the full faith and credit, and most importantly, the taxing power of the issuer. If you buy a GIGO bond, you are trusting that the city will use its ability to tax its citizens to pay you back.
When we say taxing power at the local level, like a city, a town, or a school district, we are primarily talking about ad valorem taxes. That's a fancy Latin phrase that literally translates to according to value. In the real world, that just means property taxes. Taxes based on the assessed value of real estate. So Mayor Mike is literally putting the town's taxpayers, the homeowners, on the hook to pay back the people who buy the bonds for his gold statue.
And because he is putting the taxpayers on the hook, because he is mortgaging their future property taxes, there is a massive procedural hurdle he has to clear. He cannot just find a piece of paper and borrow the money.
This is a huge rule. Watch out for this on the exam, the voter approval rule.
General obligation bonds require voter approval, period. You cannot pledge the full faith and credit and property taxes of a town without asking the people who actually live there and pay those taxes. The city has to hold a public referendum. The voters have to go to the ballot box and say yes or no to taking on this debt.
Let's imagine Careless Carl gets elected to the city council. Carl hates red tape. He tries to issue a GIGO bond quietly on a Tuesday afternoon without telling anyone. He completely forgets to hold a referendum. What happens?
Oh, that bond is dead on arrival.
The bond is invalid. You absolutely must have voter approval for a GIGO bond. I want you to remember that fact. Lock it away, because when we talk about revenue bonds in a few minutes, the rules are the exact opposite.
Now, within the world of GIGO bonds, you need to understand that there are two distinct flavors, and they carry very different levels of risk for the investor. Unlimited tax GIGO bonds and limited tax GIGO bonds.
Hold on. If both are backed by taxes, what makes one riskier than the other?
It is all about the legal ceiling on the taxing power. An unlimited tax go bond means the town has the legal authority to raise property taxes as high as necessary, literally to the moon, without any legal restriction to ensure the bondholders get paid.
Okay.
There is no statutory cap on the tax rate. For a bondholder, this is the safest possible scenario.
Prudent Penny loves an unlimited tax go bond. If Mayor Mike horribly mismanages the town's budget or if there's a recession, Penny doesn't care. Mayor Mike is legally obligated to just squeeze the taxpayers harder and harder until Penny gets her interest check. It's brutal for the homeowner, but fantastic for the investor.
A limited tax go bond, however, is much riskier for the investor. With this type of bond, the town's taxing power is artificially capped by a local statute or a state constitution. For example, the law might clearly state that the town cannot tax property at more than 1% of its assessed value, no matter what.
So wait, what happens if Mayor Mike's town hits that 1% maximum cap, they've collected all the taxes they legally can, and they still don't have enough money in the bank to pay the bondholders their interest?
Then the bondholders are out of luck. They face a default.
Wow.
Yeah, the town legally cannot raise taxes any further to make up the shortfall. That's why limited tax GOs carry more credit risk and typically have to offer a slightly higher yield to convince investors like Penny to take on that added risk.
Okay, so let's say Prudent Penny is analyzing Mayor Mike's town before she buys a Corgo bond. She's not just taking the bond council's legal opinion, right? She's doing her own homework. How do rating agencies like Moody's or S&P and smart investors like Penny actually judge the creditworthiness of a town? What specific metrics are they looking at?
They are looking broadly at the economic health and vitality of the community. First, they look at the tax base. Are property values going up, which means more tax revenue, or are they crashing?
Right.
They look at economic diversity. If Mayor Mike's town relies entirely on one massive auto plant, and that plant announces it's relocating to Mexico, the town's tax base will collapse overnight. That's high risk. They also scrutinize unfunded pension liabilities, which are a massive hidden drain on many municipal budgets.
And they look closely at population trends. This is a huge factor.
Right. And to fully understand why population matters so much, we have to introduce a concept called overlapping debt.
Okay, I always struggle with this one. Paint a picture of overlapping debt for us. Make it real.
Imagine a working-class homeowner living in a modest house in Mayor Mike's town. Mayor Mike taxes that property to pay for the city's COCO bonds, the gold statue debt. But that homeowner doesn't just live in the city. They also live within a larger county. And the county taxes that exact same property to pay for county JOA bonds, like a new courthouse. Furthermore, the homeowner lives within a specific school district, which levies its own taxes on that exact same property to pay for new high schools.
Oh, wow. So that's overlapping debt. It's multiple separate municipal entities all drawing water from the exact same well. That one poor homeowner is getting squeezed by three different tax collectors simultaneously.
Exactly.
So if you are Penny and you're analyzing the city's debt burden, you can't just look at the city's debt in a vacuum and say, oh, it's low. You have to look at the total overlapping debt burden on those taxpayers to see if they're about to break.
Yes, which brings us directly to population trends. I have a direct question for you to test your logic.
Let's hear it. Listener, get ready to do some mental math.
Let's say the total debt of Mayor Mike's town stays exactly the same. Is $100 million. It does not go up by a single penny. But the citizens get so sick of Mayor Mike's endless taxes and his gold statue obsession that half the town packs up their moving trucks and leaves for the state next door.
Wow, okay.
What happens to the debt per capita?
Take a beat here. Think about the math. Total debt is flat. The population is cut in half. What happens to the debt burden per resident? Think about it.
It skyrockets. Debt per capita is simply the total debt divided by the population. If the denominator, the population shrinks, the ratio explodes. A declining population is a massive screaming red flag for go-go bond credit quality because it means there are fewer and fewer taxpayers left to shoulder the exact same mountain of debt.
It's like going out to a fancy dinner with 10 friends and agreeing to split a $1,000 bill. It's $100 each, no big deal. But if five of your friends sneak out the back door of the restaurant before the check comes, the bill is still $1,000, but now it's $200 for the people left at the table. The financial burden doubled without the actual bill changing at all.
That is an excellent analogy.
Hmm.
Now, there is one very specific math trap the exam loves to lay regarding JOA bonds and debt calculations.
Okay, what's the trap? How do they try to trick us?
When rating agencies look at a city's debt burden, they focus on a metric called net direct debt. And the formula is simple, but really easy to mess up. It is total debt minus self-supporting debt.
Wait, I need you to define that. What exactly is self-supporting debt?
Self-supporting debt is almost always revenue bonds. Let's say Mayor Mike's town has $100 million in total debt on the books, but $30 million of that debt is a specific revenue bond issued to build a new water treatment plant.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, the general taxpayers do not pay for that water bond through their property taxes.
Yeah.
The people who pay their monthly water utility bills pay for it. The project literally supports itself with its own revenues.
Ah, I see. So the general property taxpayers are only on the hook for the remaining $70 million.
Exactly.
So if an exam question asks you to calculate the net debt, and they give you a list of numbers, total debt, overlapping debt, and they casually mention some revenue bonds, you must subtract those revenue bonds from the total debt figure.
Yes, you have to.
Careless Carl just adds everything together, forgets to subtract, and he gets the math question wrong. Prudent Penny spots the revenue bonds, subtracts the self-supporting debt, and finds the true, accurate net debt burden on the taxpayers.
All right, let's pivot the story. Mayor Mike has a problem.
He sure does. The voters in Mayor Mike's town are not stupid. They held the required public referendum for the general obligation bond to build the solid gold statue, and they voted it down overwhelmingly. They rioted. They showed up at City Hall and threw tomatoes at him.
A highly sensible electorate, honestly. Property taxes for a vanity statue is a tough sell.
Exactly. So Mike is frustrated, but he is persistent. He pivots his strategy. He says, fine, if I can't use your property taxes to build a statue, I'm going to build a massive, ridiculous toll road to a deserted island instead.
Of course he is.
But because he knows the voters will never approve more taxes, he has to use a completely different financing structure. He needs a revenue bond.
Let's define the fundamental basics here. A revenue bond is backed only by the specific revenue generated by a specific project or facility. It is not backed by property taxes, and it is absolutely not backed by the full faith and credit of the municipality.
Let's make that concrete. If you buy a revenue bond for a toll road, you get paid your interest from the tolls collected in the booths, period. If you buy a revenue bond for a new hospital wing, you get paid from the patient billing and insurance payouts. Airport bonds are paid from landing fees charged to airlines. Water and sewer bonds are paid from monthly utility bills. The project pays for itself.
And because the bond is not backed by property taxes, there is a massive, highly testable difference from JGO bonds.
Direct comparison time. Let's make this crystal clear.
Revenue bonds do not require voter approval. Mayor Mike does not need to ask the citizens for permission, and he does not need to hold a referendum to build his toll road.
Wow.
Why? Because he isn't putting their property taxes on the line. If the toll road is a spectacular failure and nobody drives on it, the bondholders take the loss, not the local taxpayers.
But wait, Mayor Mike can't just issue bonds on a whim, right? Investors like Prudent Penny aren't idiots. They aren't just going to hand him $50 million for a toll road to a deserted island just because he promises it's a good idea. He needs proof.
Right. She doesn't need voter approval, but revenue bonds require a feasibility study.
Mm-hmm.
The issuer has to hire an outside independent consulting firm, usually engineers and accountants, to deeply analyze the proposed project.
Right, to see if it actually works.
Exactly. The study determines if there's actually enough public demand to generate the revenue needed to pay for the daily operations, the maintenance, and most importantly, the debt service to the bondholders.
So some independent guy with a spreadsheet has to look at Mike's plan and say, will commuters actually pay $5 each way to drive to an island inhabited only by seagulls? The feasibility study is the absolute bedrock of a revenue bonds credit analysis. If the feasibility study says the math doesn't work, the bond doesn't get issued. No feasibility study equals no revenue bond.
Now, let's say Prudent Penny reads the feasibility study, and by some miracle, it actually looks okay. Maybe there's a secret resort on that island. But she still isn't handing over her money yet. She demands ironclad legal protections before she invests. These protections are formally written into the bond's trust indenture, or bond resolution. We call them protective covenants.
Let's break down the major covenants Penny is looking for. First, the rate covenant.
This is arguably the most important one. The issuer legally promises to set the user fees, the tolls, in this case, high enough to cover all the operating expenses and the debt service, usually with a healthy safety cushion built in. Mike has to legally swear that if revenues dip, he will raise the tolls to make up the difference.
Then there's the maintenance covenant. Mike promises to keep the road paved, fix the potholes, and clear the snow so people actually keep using it. If the road falls apart, revenues stop. The insurance covenant means he has to insure the physical road against damage, like earthquakes or floods.
And critically, we have the additional bonds test, or the ABT.
Okay, I always get confused by the ABT. Why do we need an additional bonds test? Let's act this out. Say Penny buys the bonds today. The road opens, it makes $1 million a year in tolls, and Penny is owed $500,000 in debt service. She's happy, right? She has plenty of coverage. But what happens if Mike gets greedy?
If there is no ABT, Mike could decide to issue a second massive batch of bonds for the exact same road next year. That means he now owes another $500,000 to new investors. Now the road makes $1 million, but he owes $1 million total. Penny's safety cushion is entirely gone. Her security has been completely diluted.
Ah, so the additional bonds test prevents Mike from doing that. It legally restricts the issuer from selling new parity bonds, meaning bonds with an equal claim on the toll revenue, unless the facility's revenues meet a specific high historical threshold to prove it can handle the extra debt. It acts as a shield to protect existing bondholders like Penny from having their investment diluted by greedy issuers.
Exactly. Okay, now we arrive at the ultimate showdown in the revenue bond section. This is a huge exam topic, the flow of funds.
Yes. The flow of funds dictates the exact priority of who gets paid when the cash actually comes in. Imagine the toll booths collecting dollar bills all month long. At the end of the month, there's a big pile of cash sitting on Mayor Mike's desk. Who takes their cut first? There are two structures you have to know, gross revenue pledge and net revenue pledge.
Let's compare them directly because the exam will ask you to differentiate them. Let's start with the gross revenue pledge. Under a gross pledge, the bondholders get paid their debt service first, right off the absolute top from the gross revenues, before the maintenance crew gets paid to fill potholes, before the toll booth operators get their salaries, the bondholders take their cut.
Think of the memory trick. Gross equals go first. Bondholders go first. Obviously, this is much more protective for prudent Penny. She gets her money before anyone else even touches it. She loves a gross pledge.
Now let's look at the net revenue pledge. This works completely differently. Under a net pledge, operations and maintenance, which we abbreviate as O&M, gets paid first.
Wait, O&M goes first.
Yeah, O&M first. The maintenance crew fixes the potholes. The snowplows buy gas. The toll booth operators get their weekly salaries. Then, whatever cash is left over the net revenue is used to pay the bondholders their debt service.
The memory trick here, net equals next. Operations get paid first. Bondholders are next in line. Now, let me push back here. Why on earth would an investor like Penny ever agree to a net pledge if it's clearly less protective? Why let the snowplow guy get paid before her?
Because it's a matter of long-term survival for the project. If the road falls into severe disrepair, if the potholes destroy tires, or if the toll booths aren't staffed, commuters will find a different route. The revenue will drop to zero. Paying for essential operations and maintenance actually protects the long-term viability of the revenue stream that pays the bondholders.
Okay, that actually makes perfect sense. It keeps the golden goose alive. Now, here is a trap you need to watch out for.
If an exam question asks you a general question about a revenue bond and does not specifically state whether it's a gross or net pledge, you must assume it is a net revenue pledge. Net is the overwhelming default standard in the real-world municipal bond industry.
Assume net. Net pays O&M first. Say it out loud right now wherever you are listening. Net pays O&M first.
We also need to talk about how we measure safety. We use coverage ratios, specifically the debt service coverage ratio, or DSCR. This measures exactly how much of a safety cushion the project has built in.
The formula is net revenue divided by annual debt service. Let's say the trust indenture legally requires Mayor Mike to maintain a 1.25 at DSCR. What does that actually mean in dollars and cents?
It means the project must generate enough net revenue to cover the debt service one full time, PLUS, an extra 25% safety margin. For every $1 the road owes to bondholders, it must generate $1.25 in net revenue. That extra 25 cents is the cushion in case traffic dips during a recession.
Careless Carl sees 1.25x on the exam and thinks it means 25% of the revenue goes to pay the debt. Wrong. It means there is a 25% cushion above the required debt payment.
One last trap in this segment regarding credit enhancements, specifically municipal bond insurance.
No, this is a classic trick. How does this work?
Sometimes a municipal issuer has a weak credit rating on their own. So to attract investors and lower their borrowing costs, they pay a hefty premium to a third-party insurance company, like Assured Guaranty or MBIA, to guarantee the bond. If Mayor Mike's toll road fails and he defaults, the insurance company steps in and legally promises to pay the principal and interest to the bondholders.
Here is the scenario the exam will give you. Careless Carl looks at Mayor Mike's town. The town's underlying rating is BB, which is junk status. Carl buys a bond issued by the town, but he doesn't bother to read the fine print that clearly states the bond is insured by a massive company rated AAA. A year later, Carl gets nervous and tries to sell the bond in a panic at a steep junk bond discount. He gets ripped off. Why?
Because an insured bond inherits the credit rating of the insurance company. The issuer's junk rating is completely irrelevant to the market price. If the insurer is AAA, the bond trades in the secondary market as an AAA bond. The insurance entirely substitutes for the issuer's weak credit quality. Prudent Penny knows this. She checks the insurance status, and she prices her bonds accurately.
All right, take a deep breath. We are moving into the Muni multiverse, short-term notes and special bonds.
Let's check in on Mayor Mike. His toll road to nowhere has actually passed the feasibility study. The revenue bonds are successfully issued, construction is starting, and the bulldozers are running. But Mike has a massive immediate cash flow problem.
Oh no.
He needs to pay the construction workers their wages this Friday. But the bond proceeds, or the expected tax revenues won't physically hit the town's bank account for another 6 months. He has a gap.
He needs a bridge. He essentially needs a payday loan for his city. That's exactly what short-term anticipation notes are. They are designed to bridge the temporal gap between when massive expenses hit today and when expected revenues arrive tomorrow. They're almost always under 1 year in maturity.
And the naming convention is incredibly straightforward. Don't overcomplicate these. The acronym tells you exactly how the note will be paid back.
Let's run through them.
PANS, Tax Anticipation Notes. Mayor Mike needs cash to pay the police force today. He issues a TAN, and he will pay the note holders back when the big property tax checks clear in November.
RANS, Revenue Anticipation Notes. This is bridging the gap until other non-tax revenue, like a promised state aid payment or federal matching funds, arrives in the mail.
Tax and Revenue Anticipation Notes, a combination of the first two. It's backed by future taxes and future revenues.
BANS, Bond Anticipation Notes. Mayor Mike is going to issue a huge 20-year, $50 million long-term bond next year, but he needs cash to start pouring concrete right now. He issues a ban, takes the short-term cash, and he pays it off using the massive proceeds from the big bond sale later.
GNs, Grand Anticipation Notes. The city is waiting on a specific confirmed check from the federal government for a highway beautification grant. They issue a JAN against that expected check.
It's all right there in the name. T's for tax, R's for revenue, B's for bond, G is for grant. They are short-term bridges.
Now, let's wade into the exam minefield, the special types of bonds. These are the weird ones that don't fit neatly into the standard Django or revenue boxes. We'll start with the safest one on the board, double-barreled bonds.
Double-barreled. It sounds cool, like a shotgun. A double-barreled bond is backed by both a specific revenue source and the full faith and credit and taxing power of the issuer. It gives the investor absolute dual security. If the toll road revenue falls short because nobody is driving, Mayor Mike must legally dip into the property taxes to make up the difference. It is the best of both worlds for an investor.
Next, we have COPs, or Certificates of Participation, and Lease Revenue Bonds. These are very similar structurally.
This is where a municipality builds something, like a new police station or a courthouse, but instead of issuing a traditional GIGO bond that requires voter approval, they essentially lease the building. The investors buy shares in the lease payments.
But there is very specific testable risk here called annual appropriation risk. The city council has to vote every single year to formally appropriate the funds in the budget to pay the lease. If they get mad, or if the budget is tight and they decide they don't want the police station anymore, they can theoretically just not appropriate the funds, break the lease, and walk away. That uncertainty makes them riskier than standard bonds.
Wait, they can just walk away from a police station? That sounds insane.
They can. I mean, their credit rating would be completely destroyed and nobody would ever lend them money again. But legally, yes, they can walk away without defaulting on a bond because it's technically a lease.
That's wild. Okay, now for the biggest trap of this section. Moral obligation bonds.
A moral obligation bond happens when a state agency issues a revenue bond for a public project, and the state legislature adds a soft promise. They say, if the revenues from this project ever fall short, we promise we will try to appropriate state funds to make you whole.
Let me ask you a direct question. Ready? If a moral obligation bond defaults, the revenues crash, and the state legislature decides they don't actually want to pay to bail it out, Can prudent Penny sue the state to force them to give her money? Take a heat. What do you think?
No, absolutely not. It is a moral commitment, not a legal obligation. They are legally allowed to just shrug and say, sorry, we changed our minds, we aren't paying.
Oh.
Yeah, the word obligation in the name is a complete misnomer designed to make it sound safer than it is. They are much riskier than GUGO bonds because there is absolutely zero legal recourse for the investor if the state walks away.
It's the, I promise to pay you back, but my fingers are crossed behind my back bond. Do not fall for it.
Before we leave the multiverse, we need to touch on the tax exceptions. We've said that munis are tax-free at the federal level, but not always.
Right. AMT bonds or private activity bonds. If Mayor Mike issues a muni bond to build an industrial park specifically for a private corporation to use, the federal government steps in and says, hey, that's not for the public good, like a school or a road. That's a subsidy for a private company. The interest on that bond becomes a tax preference item for the alternative minimum tax.
If an incredibly wealthy investor is subject to the AMT, they might actually have to pay federal taxes on that specific bond's interest. Therefore, AMT bonds have to offer a slightly higher yield in the market to attract buyers who are willing to take on that potential tax risk.
And finally, fully taxable munis, like Build America bonds, which were issued primarily during the 2009 financial crisis. They are municipal bonds, but the interest is 100% federally taxable. Why would anyone buy them? Because they were designed to attract pension funds and foreign investors who don't pay U.S. taxes anyway, so they don't care about tax exemptions. They just want the higher yield.
Okay, let's shift gears completely. We need to talk about municipal fund securities.
Let's check in on Mayor Mike. The toll road is fully funded. The bridge loans are paid off. Mayor Mike is sitting at his desk, and he realizes he has a bunch of idle cash sitting around in the town's checking account. He also realizes his twin daughters are going to college in 10 years, and he hasn't saved a single dime for their tuition.
First, we have to address the elephant in the room. Why on earth are college savings plans and disability accounts sitting right in the middle of the municipal securities chapter?
It's a great question. When you look at a 529 plan, it's basically just a basket of mutual funds, right? Why is it a muni? The MSRB, or MOL pops from earlier, decided years ago that because 529 plans, ABLE accounts, and local government investment pools are technically created and issued by state governments, they fall under MSRB jurisdiction. They are officially classified as municipal fund securities.
That means all the strict rules for muni dealers, the suitability requirements, the advertising restrictions, the disclosure documents apply to whoever is selling a 529 plan. So you have to know them for the Series 7. Let's start with 529 college savings plans.
The mechanics are simple but powerful. You put after-tax dollars into the account. There is no federal tax deduction for contributions, though many states give you a state income tax deduction if you invest in your home state's plan. The money in the account grows tax-deferred, and when you pull it out for qualified education expenses, which means tuition, books, room and board, and computers, it comes out completely tax-free.
And there are two major things that separate 529s from other tax-advantaged accounts, like Roth IRAs or Coverdell education savings accounts.
Watch out, these are heavily tested exceptions.
There are NO income limits on who can contribute to a 529. A billionaire CEO can open one. And there are NO age limits on the beneficiary. You can open a 529 for yourself at age 50 because you want to go back to grad school.
Mayor Mike decides to use a strategy called superfunding. This is highly testable.
Superfunding allows a contributor to front-load 5 years' worth of the annual gift tax exclusion in a single, massive lump sum. The current annual limit is $19,000 per year per person. So Mike can drop five times that amount, $95,000, into a 529 plan today for one single kid, without triggering any gift tax penalties or digging into his lifetime exemption.
95 grand at once. He just can't make any more tax-free gifts to that specific kid for the next 5 years. It is an incredible estate planning tool for wealthy clients who want to move money out of their taxable estate quickly.
Now, what happens if Mike's kid turns 18 and decides they don't want to go to college? They want to be an influencer. Can he change the beneficiary?
Yes, but it has to be to a family member of the original beneficiary. You can roll it to a sibling, a first cousin, even a parent, without penalty.
And here is a brand new tax rule you need to be aware of. Listen closely, because this is relatively new material.
As of 2024, the government threw us a bone. If you have money trapped in a 529 plan that isn't being used because your kid got a full scholarship or didn't go to school, you can roll up to $35,000 lifetime from that 529 directly into a Roth IRA in the beneficiary's name.
But there is a massive catch that the exam will test. The 529 account must have been open for at least 15 years to qualify for this Roth rollover. You cannot just open it today, fund it, and roll it into a Roth tomorrow to bypass contribution limits. It has to season for 15 years.
Okay, what if Careless Carl opens a 529 for his kid, funds it, and then 5 years later he decides he really wants a new jet ski? He withdraws the money to buy the jet ski. That is a non-qualified withdrawal. What happens?
Carl gets crushed by the IRS. For a non-qualified withdrawal, the earnings portion of the account, the profit it made, is subject to ordinary income tax, PLUS, a harsh 10% penalty. Carl thought he's getting tax-free money. Instead, he's paying his top marginal tax rate plus a penalty on all the growth. Don't be Carl.
Let's touch on ABLE accounts, achieving a better life experience.
ABLE accounts are tax-advantaged savings vehicles specifically designed for individuals with disabilities and their families. They function very similarly to 529s. After tax money goes in, the money grows tax-free, and it comes out tax-free if used for qualified disability expenses, like housing, transportation, or medical care.
The key testable point here is the age of onset. To qualify for an ABLE account, the individual's disability must have occurred before a certain age. Currently, that age is 26. Note that the law is changing, and in 2026, it is expanding to age 46, but you need to know the onset requirement is the defining gateway.
And finally, LGIPs, local government investment pools. Mayor Mike has $5 million in Idletown cash sitting around from collected taxes. He doesn't want to lock it up in 20-year bonds. He might need it next month. He wants liquidity, but he wants a little yield. He puts it in an LGIP.
An LGIP is basically a money market mutual fund specifically built for municipal governments. It's usually operated by the state treasurer. It gives local towns liquidity, safety of principal, and diversification for their short-term cash. Just know the acronym and what it does.
All right, deep breath. We're entering the heaviest mechanics of the session, call features and refunding. This is where the math and the logic get incredibly intertwined.
Let's check back in with Mayor Mike. He built his toll road 10 years ago. Back then, inflation was soaring, interest rates were high, so he had to issue his revenue bonds with a hefty 6% coupon just to get investors to buy them. But today, the economy has fundamentally changed. Interest rates have plummeted, new bonds are paying 3%. Mike looks at his town budget and realizes he is overpaying massively. He wants a do-over.
This brings us to call features. An optional call gives the issuer, Mayor Mike, the legal right to redeem the bonds before they mature. He can call them in, pay off the principal early, and permanently stop paying that expensive 6% interest.
Let's be very clear about motivations here. Who does an optional call benefit? It benefits the issuer, always.
Yeah.
Mike calls the bonds when rates drop so he can refinance the debt at the new, lower rates. It saves the town millions.
But what about Prudent Penny? She bought that bond. She loved earning 6% and the rest of the market was only paying 3%. It was a cash cow. When Mike calls her bond, she gets her principal back early. But now she faces something terrible.
Reinvestment risk. This is the dark side of call features for investors. Let's do the math. Penny had $100,000 invested at 6%. She was making $6,000 a year. Mike calls the bond, hands her the $100,000 back, and says, "Have a nice day." Penny turns around to the market, but the market is only paying 3% now. She reinvests her $100,000, and now she's only making $3,000 a year. Her income just got cut in half.
Because callable bonds are inherently riskier for investors due to this reinvestment risk, they must trade at slightly higher yields than non-callable bonds to compensate the investor for taking on that risk.
Now, contrast an optional call with a mandatory call, which is also known as a sinking fund. A mandatory call is not a strategic choice made by Mayor Mike to save money. The issuer is legally required by the trust indenture to retire a specific portion of the bonds every single year on a set schedule. It's like forced amortization to ensure the debt gets paid down.
And then there's the extraordinary call or catastrophe call.
Imagine a massive Category 5 hurricane sweeps through and completely destroys Mayor Mike's toll road. The bridge is gone. The road is underwater. It obviously can't collect tolls anymore. How do the bondholders get paid? The hazard insurance money kicks in, triggers the extraordinary call, and uses that insurance payout to pay the bondholders off early. It's triggered by a physical disaster, not by interest rate movements.
Okay, we are approaching one of the most critical, heavily tested traps in the entire municipal section.
This one trips everyone up. Let's walk through it slowly. Yield to call versus yield to maturity.
When a broker-dealer quotes a callable bond to a customer over the phone or on a confirmation screen, there are two possible yields that could occur. There is the yield to maturity, which is what the investor earns if the bond goes the full distance to its final date. And there is the yield to call, which is what the investor owns if the bond gets called away early. Which one is the dealer legally required to quote?
MSRB rules dictate that you must always, always quote the lower yield. It's a concept called yield to worst. You have to give the customer the absolute worst case scenario so they aren't unpleasantly surprised.
Let's do the mental math to figure out which one is the worst. If you buy a bond at a premium, meaning you paid more than par value, say $110 for a $100 bond, your worst case scenario is getting called early. Why?
Because I'm losing that $10 of premium over time. If the bond goes for 10 years, I lose $1 a year. But if they call it in 2 years, I lose that $10 incredibly fast. It crushes my overall return.
So for a premium callable bond, the yield to call is mathematically lower than the yield to maturity. Therefore, you quote the yield to call.
Correct. But let's flip it. What if you buy a bond at a discount? You pay $90 for a bond that will eventually pay you back $100 at par. If I buy at a discount, getting called early is actually fantastic. I get my $100 par value back way faster than I expected. My yield skyrockets. So for a discount bond, the yield to call is actually the higher number. The worst case scenario is having to wait the full 10 years to get my $100. So for a discount bond, the yield to maturity is the lower number, and that is what you quote. Always quote the lowest yield, yield to worst.
Let's flip the script entirely. We talked about call options, which heavily benefit the issuer. What about put options?
A put feature benefits the investor. It gives Prudent Penny the legal right to put the bond back to the issuer, to essentially force Mayor Mike to buy it back from her at par value before it matures.
When would she actually use this superpower? If interest rates rise? Let's say her bond pays 3% and suddenly inflation spikes and market rates jump to 6%. Her 3% bond is now a terrible investment. She exercises her put option, forces Mike to give her $100,000 back, and she immediately reinvests that cash into a new bond paying the higher 6% rate.
Because a put option is such a massive advantage for the investor, it practically eliminates interest rate risk. Put bonds carry lower yields than comparable bonds without puts. You literally pay for the privilege of having that escape hatch by accepting a lower return up front. Less risk, less reward.
Okay, let's go back to Mayor Mike. He wants to call his expensive 6% bonds to refinance at the new 3% rates. How does he actually execute the mechanics of refinancing a city? He does what is called a refunding. He issues brand new 3% bonds, takes the cash from that new sale, and uses it to pay off the old 6% bonds.
And here's the trap. You have to distinguish between a current refunding and an advance refunding. The line in the sand is exactly 90 days.
I have a direct question for you. Mayor Mike issues his new 3% bonds to replace the old ones. He executes this new bond sale exactly 89 days before the formal call date on the old bonds. Is this classified as a current refunding or an advance refunding?
Take a beat. Think about the timeline. 89 days. Which side of the line is it on?
It is a current refunding. The magic statutory rule is 90 days. If the new bonds are issued 90 days or less before the old bonds are officially called and retired, it is a current refunding. If it is 91 days or more, it crosses into a different legal territory and becomes an advance refunding.
So how does an advance refunding, which is also commonly called pre-refunding, actually work in reality? The mechanics are wild. Let's say the call date on the old 6% bonds isn't for another 3 full years, but Mike wants to lock in today's rock-bottom 3% rates right now because he thinks rates will go back up. He issues the new bonds today, he takes the cash, but he physically cannot pay off the old bonds yet because the call date hasn't legally arrived. What does he do with the money for 3 years?
He cannot just put it in the town's checking account. He is legally required to put that cash into an irrevocable escrow account at a bank. And what does the bank buy inside that escrow account to keep the money safe and growing? U.S. Treasuries, specifically state and local government series securities, or SLGS.
So he takes the new money, buys U.S. Treasuries, and literally locks them in a bank vault. The interest generated by those ultra-safe treasuries sitting inside the vault is used to perfectly match and pay the ongoing debt service on the old 6% bonds until the 3-year clock runs out and the call date finally arrives.
And here's the magic trick that the exam loves. What happens to the credit rating of those old 6% bonds the moment they are pre-refunded?
Careless Carl looks at Mayor Mike's town rating, which is a solid A. He assumes the pre-refunded bonds are still rated A. Wrong. think about what we just said. Those old bonds are no longer relying on Mayor Mike's property taxes or his toll booths. They are now backed entirely, 100%, by U.S. Treasury sitting in an irrevocable vault. The issuer's credit rating is completely irrelevant now. The pre-refunded bonds are instantly upgraded to AAA. They become some of the absolute safest municipal bonds on the planet.
One historical note you need to be aware of: the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 killed the ability for municipalities to do tax-exempt advance refundings. If Mike wants to advance refund today to lock in rates, he has to issue taxable bonds to fill that escrow vault, which makes it much less common today. But the core mechanics of the escrow account and the automatic AAA rating upgrade are still highly testable concepts.
Before we leave refunding, we need to define ETM and crossover refunding, because they show up as tricky distractors.
ETM stands for escrow to maturity. It is structurally exactly like advance refunding, but with one key difference. Instead of setting the escrow account to pay off the bonds at the early call date, the escrow is built large enough to pay the bonds all the way to their final original maturity date. They ride out the full term, backed safely by treasuries.
Hold on, explain crossover refunding to me, because my brain always ties itself in knots on this one.
In a standard advance refunding, the escrow account pays the interest on the OLD bonds until the call date. In a crossover refunding, the escrow account pays the interest on the EW bonds first. The old bonds continue to be paid from their original revenue source, like the toll booths. Then, on a specific crossover date, the escrow account switches, uses its principal to retire the old bonds, and the original revenue source takes over paying the new bonds. It literally crosses over.
Okay, that makes sense. It's the opposite flow. All right, we are entering the final stretch: diversification and marketability.
Let's check in with Prudent Penny one last time. She is doing her annual portfolio review. She opens her statement and realizes she owns a massive ton of Mayor Mike's JUGO bonds, his toll road revenue bonds, and his water utility bonds. She realizes she has a huge problem. If Mayor Mike manages to drive the entire town into bankruptcy, she loses everything. She needs to diversify.
There are three primary dimensions of municipal diversification you need to know for the exam: geographical, type, and rating.
Geographical is the most obvious. Do not buy bonds all from the exact same town or the exact same state. If you own a portfolio consisting entirely of Florida municipal bonds and a massive catastrophic hurricane wipes out the state's infrastructure and tax base, your entire portfolio is crushed. You need to spread it out. Buy some Texas bonds, some New York bonds, some Ohio bonds.
Type diversification means mixing JUGO bonds and revenue bonds. Remember, JUGO bonds are backed by property taxes. Revenue bonds are backed by specific projects. They react very differently to economic stresses. In a housing crash, JUGO bonds might suffer. In a pandemic where nobody is driving, toll road revenue bonds will suffer. Mix them up.
And rating diversification simply means blending those super safe, lower yielding AAA bonds with some slightly lower rated, higher yielding BBB bonds to get a better overall yield without taking on total junk bond risk.
But here is the major trade-off trap regarding geography. This is a classic Series 7 scenario: the home state tax trap.
We talked about the triple tax-free benefit in the very beginning. If you live in California and you buy a California muni, you pay no federal tax and no state tax. It's a massive tax benefit.
So Careless Carl, who lives in California, decides he wants to pay zero taxes. He puts 100% of his life savings into California municipal bonds to maximize his tax savings. What is the fundamental problem with Carl's strategy?
He has taken on massive, concentrated geographic and event risk. If California has a devastating earthquake or a severe prolonged state budget crisis, Carl's entire portfolio crashes simultaneously. The exam will test this exact trade-off. The intense desire for the home state tax benefit actively works against the principle of geographical diversification. You constantly have to balance the tax savings against the concentration risk.
Finally, let's talk about marketability. This is really just about liquidity. How easy is it to sell a bond when you need cash? Careless Carl tries to sell some of his bonds in a panic on a Tuesday morning, and nobody will buy them. Why?
Several distinct factors affect marketability. The biggest one is block size. The standard accepted trading unit for municipal bonds is a round lot of $100,000 face value. If Carl is trying to sell a random $15,000 worth of bonds, that's called an odd lot. Institutional buyers and big mutual funds don't want to mess around with tiny pieces of debt. Therefore, odd lots trade at much wider spreads and are significantly harder to sell at a fair price.
The coupon rate also matters immensely. If Carl is trying to sell an old bond with a tiny 2% coupon in a modern market where brand new bonds are paying 5%, Absolutely nobody wants his 2% bond unless he drops the sale price drastically to compensate. Below market coupons are highly illiquid.
Call features actively hurt marketability too. If a bond is callable tomorrow, nobody wants to buy it today because they know it might just get ripped away from them by the issuer immediately. Investors want certainty, and call features destroy certainty.
Think about it logically. High ratings, near par prices, market rate coupons, well-known issuers, standard round lots. These are the things that make a bond marketable. The more normal and standard it looks, the easier it trades.
All right, put your pencils down. That was a massive, heavy amount of information. Let's lock it into your brain with a conversational recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from this unit.
Let's do it. If you take absolutely nothing else away from this hour, remember Mayor Mike. Mayor Mike cannot build his statue using property taxes without asking the voters first.
Yeah.
General obligation bonds always, always require voter approval. But if he builds a toll road, revenue bonds do not.
And when you are calculating the net debt burden of a town, you have to subtract the self-supporting revenue bonds. The taxpayers don't pay the water bond, so subtract it from the total debt.
When it comes to the flow of funds, remember the wordplay, net equals next. A net revenue pledge pays operations and maintenance first to keep the road open, and bondholders are next. Gross means bondholders go first.
When a dealer is quoting a callable bond to a client, they must be honest about the worst-case scenario. Always, quote, yield to worst. For a premium bond that's losing value, that's yield to call.
The refunding timeline is simple. If the new bonds are issued 90 days or less before the call date, it's a current refunding. More than 90 days, it's an advance refunding.
And if those bonds are advance refunded, they are instantly upgraded to a AAA rating because they are now backed by U.S. Treasuries locked in an escrow vault, not the issuer's shaky credit.
The MSRB writes the rules for the dealers, but Fianara and the SEC actually carry the handcuffs and enforce them.
And finally, just because a municipal bond is exempt from SEC registration does not mean it is exempt from the anti-fraud rules. Fraud is fraud.
Wow. We covered the entire foundation. But remember, this is only part one of the municipal beast. Before we go, we want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over before you tackle the next chapter.
We spent this entire session hammering home the idea that municipal bonds are prized because they are exempt from federal income taxes, and often state taxes too. That's all point of buying them, right? But I want you to think about this specific scenario. What happens if you buy a municipal bond in the secondary market for $900, and 2 years later, you sell it to another investor for $1,000? You just made a $100 profit on the trade. Does the municipal tax exemption protect your capital gains? Or does the IRS want a cut of your trading profit? Think about that carefully before you move on to part two.
I love that. A cliffhanger for a finance test. You are now fully armed with the logic, the math, and the trap spotting skills to absolutely beat the first half of the Muni section on the Series 7. Channel prudent Penny, laugh at careless Carl, and go crush it. We will see you on the next deep dive.